Hi, Jennifer Berkshire. Welcome to KABU.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jennifer Berkshire writes about education and politics for The Nation, The New Republic, The Washington Post, Rethinking Schools, and other publications. The creator and co-host of the education podcast, Have You Heard? She teaches aspiring journalists at Boston College, the Labor Studies program at UMass Amherst, and Yale. She wrote the book, A Wolf at the Schoolhouse Door, The Dismantling of Public Education and the Future of School. This exposes those who, for the last 50 years, have sought to privatize the public schools. Her latest book, The Education War, A Citizen's Guide and Defense Manual, it'll be published next year, discusses how the progressive community can defeat the hard right that in the last few years in some states, that is states with radical right-wing legislatures and governors like Florida and Texas, they banned teaching on race history, also banned any books and lessons sympathetic to LGBTI people, and they threatened with prison teachers that disobey these laws. That's in the hard right states. But also in all states, this radical right have funded organizers that have built parent groups that are ready to attack teachers, schools, and school districts that commit these intellectual sins. Jennifer Berkshire has thus studied and written about the two major threats to public education we now face and how progressives have fought them and are still being fought. That's what we'll talk about today. So, Jennifer, first we have to describe the enemies of public education, from the privatizers to today's right-wing attacks, how they operate, their aims, their strategies, the different social forces they represent, and how, with all their differences, they might be helping one another.
Well, when our last book, which came out in 2020, was getting ready to reach the world, we were doing that, putting the final touches on it in terms of copy editing. And what was becoming obvious at that point was that the pandemic and the school shutdowns were going to present a tremendous opportunity for a certain brand of libertarian conservatives who really, since the days of Milton Friedman, had been arguing for school vouchers. And so schools had barely shut down before the Heritage Foundation sends out, you know, what was meant to look like an official government report encouraging states to immediately restructure the way that they fund schools, give some portion of money directly to the parents in the form of what they call education savings accounts. And so then we fast forward through the pandemic, and here we are today when, schools are long reopened. In some states, they weren't closed for very long at all. And I think most people would identify the ferocious culture wars as the biggest threats to public schools right now. And we're seeing that the exact same policy item is being basically rammed through in all these states. And so for me, it was a real wake-up call how, you know, like this very old idea just gets sort of rolled back out as soon as there's any opportunity to do that. And so what we're seeing right now is that in state after state, you have conservative legislators enacting what are called universal voucher programs. And the idea there is that any parent, no matter how wealthy they are, can get public funding to send their kids not just to private schools, but to basically purchase any education-related product. And so you can just go to Amazon and purchase things and call it school. And so this is happening fast. It's happening in multiple states. And it is going to present a major, major threat to public schools in those states because these universal voucher programs are enormously expensive, and they're being rolled out at a time when these same states are also slashing taxes on the wealthy. So that's what I want people to just start by wrapping their heads around, that we've got an old idea that has come rushing back to the fore and is being adopted at a scale that we've never seen before.
I don't think I understood the scope of the problem, but what I have read a good deal of is how the privatizers, their growth has greatly slowed, some because they expect big salaries for themselves, that they do it by skimping on teacher salaries or maintaining big classes or hiring unqualified people, or to set up religious or conservative schools, that they all discover that it's not so easy to hire teachers or show high test scores. And then they try to pressure parents of children who are not good test takers, pressure them to go to another school so that they can show high scores on the tests, which in fact they can't do even after kicking out a lot of kids. And then the parents complain and the entrepreneurs are stuck in scandal. And further, the reasons for replacing public schools were found to be false. This is one of their contentions, that because test scores in math and science for U.S. kids was way below Japanese kids, even that's not exactly right, and other East Asians, that for sure the U.S. would be outcompeted in developing all the new technologies, and the U.S. would become a second-rate nation. Of course, it turned out that it was the U.S. kids who spent much time, less time in schools and public schools. They had more time for independent reading, for puttering around, for experimenting, and they made the great discoveries. It came to be known that spending 12 months a year, 10 hours a day in school does not give it a chance to develop creativity or invention. Do those failings of the privateers and the charter schools and other inventions for destroying the public system, have those in fact created problems, or is that sort of a pipe dream that I've managed to generate?
I thought you described that really well. If you go back sort of decade after decade, you can see how the case, you know, the argument for why it's urgent that we dismantle our public system and replace it with a private system, how it's always changing. So, for example, right now, if you look at the states that I was just talking about, places like Florida and, you know, as of last week, North Carolina, Texas is a big one where the governor of that state is making just a full court press to get a private school voucher program. They'll use the language of test scores to talk about how the public schools are failing, even as they're seeking to shift kids into schools where they don't take tests or they don't measure school performance by test. So you're sort of like, well, how's that going to work? And something similar happened with online learning, because if you go back to the pre-pandemic period, one of the pipe dreams, as you were just saying, not only is it not easy to make money off of an education product, right? Educating kids is enormously labor intensive and it's expensive. And so for many years, the dream was that if you could just move schools online, that was going to be, you know, how you cashed in. You were going to have for-profit online learning, and there would be no limit to how big classes could be. And you would even hear Democratic type reformers like an Arne Duncan, who was Barack Obama's education chief, making the case that, you know, wouldn't it be great if we could just get one really, really good teacher and have that teacher educate a whole bunch of kids online? Well, what happens? Schools shut down during the pandemic. Whatever idealism we had about online learning evaporated within, say, a week. And that sales pitch really evaporated. I predict that you'll see it start to come back relatively quickly, but you're absolutely right. We can go back to the 1980s with the Reagan era report, A Nation at Risk, and that's when you really start to hear this drumbeat that American kids are falling behind, and as a result, we are going to fail to compete internationally. And the claims that were made were often very specific. I remember reading one. Somebody was saying, you know, that the reason that Japanese automakers were going to outcompete their American counterparts was because their auto workers were more literate. than U.S. auto workers. The push then was for charter schools. And so the problem, I think, now is that the vision of school choice that I was describing, these universal school vouchers, they're virtually unregulated. There's no accountability. There's no way to tell how the kids are doing, where the money is going, et cetera. And so then you wonder, well, how are they also going to make the argument about international competition when they're pushing kids into this completely unregulated marketplace? And I think that's really the big mystery.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour for KABU Radio 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon, talking to Jennifer Berkshire, a journalist, a teacher of journalism, a specialist in schools, has written two books and countless articles. You know, with incomes going down for the bottom 70-80% of the people and life getting more precarious, there's an enormous pressure for families that are not eating very well with kids in poverty to use the money to eat and also use the kids' labor surreptitiously. It seems to me we've created conditions that are a modern Dickensian industrial state, although it's service industries, fast food that absorbs so many teenagers as well as real teenagers, as well as kids with fake IDs. I think kids have become...
You're absolutely right.
There's so much economic pressure on them, not to mention the people who have really become demoralized and are dependent on psychoactive substances. Indeed, in Dickinson's England, the men stayed out of the factories. They sent their kids and women, and they did odd jobs and had good times in the pub. And the limited funds came in from the kids who rebelled, of course, and the ones who resorted to force, the kids, had their teeth filed down. One of the ways that the kids never had any cavities. They also couldn't chew. It was very brutal, but we have our own version of it right now.
It's such a good point because, you know, we really forget. We get caught up in the minutiae of education policy and these debates about, you know, what kind of school should it be and what kind of training should the teacher have to have. But, you know, we have public education in this country because capitalism was so out of control. It was introduced as a way of making the world less wildly unequal. And one fascinating thing that I learned in my research was that the very first parents' rights crusade in this country was in opposition to the effort to ban child labor. And you think, why would that be? And just as we see all sorts of deep-pocketed conservative groups lining up behind the parents' rights cause today, in the 1920s, you had something similar. You had conservative industry groups that were actually really opposed to the idea that kids would have to go to school because, as they saw it, inequality was the natural state of things, and that by requiring every family to send their kids to school, the state was basically putting its thumb on the scale in the interest of equality. And these industry leaders didn't like that. And so they started up all kinds of AstroTurf groups with names like, you know, Farmers and Parents United. They pushed back really hard against the idea of banning child labor and putting that ban into the Constitution. And there was enough concern at the time about government overreach that that's the reason why we don't have a ban on child labor as an amendment to our Constitution. But I think it's so important for people to remember what the country looked like at the time when public education emerged as a progressive era reform and what kind of future that people who are now so intent on dismantling it, what do they see? And it is absolutely not a coincidence that the very same states that are enacting these unregulated school voucher programs, that are telling wealthy parents, you know what, we're going to now pick up the tab for your private school tuition, that those same states are also rolling back any kind of regulation on child labor. And it's almost like they are trying to enact that bleak future that you described, that sort of Dickensian vision, where they say, you know what, we know there are going to be a lot of families, if they're given a sum of money and life is really hard, it's going to make more sense to send, you know, little Jenny to work. And also, you know, we can never forget the original vision of school vouchers that Milton Friedman, the economist, pushed for so long. His original vision was that the ultimate cost would be borne by the parents themselves. And so think about what that's going to look like. And you're going to have a lot of families that just say, you know what, I can't pay for it. And so I think it just makes more sense to send our kids to work instead.
This is Bill Resnick for the Omo Variety Hour for Cable Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, talking to Jennifer Berkshire, education journalist. You heard part one of the two-part interview, whose second part will conclude on how to fight that right-wing attack today. Today we discuss voucher systems. In voucher systems, of course, the state provides a money grant to parents of school-aged children to use as they see fit, which attracts businessmen and entrepreneurial types, seeing a big pot of money that they would control. In part two, to be broadcast next week, Jennifer and I discuss today's right-wing attacks on the schools. The right claiming that the schools are indoctrinating and debauching our children by feeding them Hate America First propaganda from the far leftists and communists. They also claim that public schools in your town are promoting and even grooming our children for what the right considers sexual perversion. The right also claims that present school curriculums make our children feel guilty and unable to learn in school because of the teaching about slavery and racism. In that part, too, we discuss how ordinary people, not surprisingly, they're not buying those arguments and they're fighting back. And that with some imagination and resources, we can build a powerful parents movement supporting public education. That's next week, 9 a.m. on the Old Mole Variety Hour.